Well, good evening, everybody. Good afternoon. Thanks for coming. Good to see everybody. So tonight we complete the Dhammapada. We have two kind of long chapters, so I want to get started right away. See if we can get through all of this. Chapters 25 and 26. All the way up to verse 200, 422 or 3, which is the end of the text. We've actually read the whole thing since whenever we started in January or so. So chapter 25, the bhikkhu. Bhikkhu, I guess you probably know, is the word that designates a male monastic. Bhikkhuni is the female. But I think in this case, we're meant to take the word as meaning a person who practices with full commitment, whatever lifestyle they may live or whatever gender they may identify with. Here in this chapter, bhikkhu means it's a portrait, this chapter, of the one who is fully dedicated and fully immersed in the Dharma. It begins like this: restraint of the eye is good, restraint of the good is restraint of the ear, restraint of the nose is good, good is restraint of the tongue, restraint of the body is good, good is restraint of speech, restraint of the mind is good, good is restraint in all circumstances. Restrained in all circumstances, the bhikkhu is released from all suffering. The one with hands restrained, feet restrained, speech restrained, who is foremost among the restrained, inwardly delighted, composed, solitary, and contented, is called a bhikkhu. So the most important word in all these verses is the word restraint. And we've talked about this before, restraint in the various traditions of Buddhism and how it appears in those different traditions. And it certainly does seem that the sage in the Dhammapada is a person of great dignity and great restraint. But as I've said before, I don't think restraint here means to be uptight or excessively worried or constrained. And in my own experience, when you practice restraint, it just becomes natural, I think. It doesn't become restrictive or repressive or oppressive. And as you practice over time, of course, you're going to change and your tastes will change. And you are happier and happier to live a simple life, not to seek out loud or wild forms of enjoyment, and to find those a little less pleasurable maybe than you did in the past. And in fact, you feel like, yes, it's pretty nice and pleasant and happy to live a quiet and a restrained life. It's kind of relaxed and easygoing, not a lot of hubbub and hustle and hassle. And the older you get, of course, the better all this sounds. So that's what these opening verses are picturing, a life like that. Sweet is the speech of bhikkhus who restrain their mouths, speak insightfully, are not conceited, and illuminate the teachings and the goal. So all speech, you know, and this is certainly what Dogen would say to us, all speech is expressing the Dharma. And when you understand this, naturally, you want to make the effort to speak truthfully and kindly without drawing attention to yourself or bragging or criticizing. I think there can be some playfulness in speech, but not if it's unkind. The classical speech practice is truthful speech, kind speech, and speech at the right time and in the right circumstances. And that's how I think we want to speak in the light of our practice. And when we speak like that, that means that sometimes it's better not to speak. than it is to speak. And so one knows how to forbear from speaking when that's the best thing to do. The bhikkhu who dwells in the Dharma, delights in the Dharma, reflects on the Dharma, recollects the Dharma, doesn't fall away from the true Dharma. So we stick to the Dharma. We are happy to be connected all the time to the Dharma. Not because we're scared that if we don't do that, something bad's going to happen to us, but because it's a delightful thing to love the Dharma and take delight in the Dharma. You know, it seems to me delightful to listen to the Dharma and study the Dharma. It always cheers you up. It cheers me up anyway. And in this sense, practice is never a constraint or a sacrifice. It's always a delight. One should not scorn what one has received, nor envy others. The mendicant who envies others doesn't become concentrated. The gods praise the mendicant who lives purely and untiringly and who doesn't scorn what he or she receives, even if receiving just a little. So we've talked about this before, the idea that mendicants are begging for their food and sometimes they get something good, sometimes they don't get something good or something unpleasant, but they always have to receive it in the same spirit. But here I want to talk about this issue of concentration, which is mentioned in the verses. And it's in our tradition, we usually don't emphasize concentration when we talk about Zazen. And that's because if we were to emphasize concentration, it might give the impression that the point of Zazen is to achieve concentration states. Which is not the case. The point of Zazen is to learn how to pay attention and how to understand your life so that you can live truthfully and beautifully. That's the point of our sitting. However, it really is true that we need a certain amount of concentration because in order to have the depth of wisdom required to overcome sort of the fundamental ignorance that keeps us bound up, we do need some intensity of mind. We do need some deeper capacity to see what is. And what this verse is saying is that shoddy conduct and shoddy thinking, envy and complaining and so on, makes the mind wobbly and unconcentrated. So a calm and settled mind and calm and settled conduct go together. The precepts in Zazen are absolutely necessary for one another. Anyone who doesn't cherish as mine anything of name or appearance, and who doesn't grieve for that which doesn't exist, is indeed called a bhikkhu. So a true practitioner is someone who really does see that there's nothing to possess and nothing special to be. One isn't anyone. There's just life, and one is life, one is alive. And this means that whatever is here in the moment of your being alive is always given. And what is given is always enough. And to wish for what is not is pretty useless and, you know, just makes you unhappy. The one who knows this and lives this is the one we call a bhikkhu. A bhikkhu dwelling in loving kindness and pleased with the Buddha's teachings attains happiness, the stilling of formations, the state of peace. So when you live in the way that is being described here, you are naturally going to be kind to others because it's the obvious thing. I mean, there's nothing apart from one in any moment of time, and that means that love is the obvious force that applies always. Stilling of formations means clarifying the fourth skanda, which can be translated as formations. The word is samskaras, sometimes it's translated as formations. We used to translate it as impulses or volitions. But basically, it's that force of consciousness that puts the world together, creates the world in our hearts. We do make up the world. We conceptualize the world into me and you and this and that, into things I want, things I don't want. A whole world of conceptualization is what we mean by formations. And when the formations are stilled, then the world kind of is just there. You know, it falls apart in a way. It's unmade, as we'll see in a moment. And then there's peace, you know, real peace. Everything can just be what it is. And this is not a temporary peace, a lull before the next storm. This is a more lasting, truer peace. Bhikkhu, bail out the boat. Emptied, it will move quickly for you. Cutting off passion and aversion, you will go to nirvana. So this is a leaky boat. We're all in a leaky boat. It's full of water. And, you know, as we go on, it gets more and more water. It's about to sink. So there's some urgency here. Bhikkhu, bail out this boat. Stop the leaking. Throw the water overboard. Start paying attention to your living. And when you start bailing, then, yeah, the boat will be empty. And an empty boat sails along quite nicely, no matter what kind of water. And here again, we notice in the language something we talked about, I think, last time, this language of cutting off at the root, cutting off the painful root of greed and hatred, because there's nothing to want and nothing to reject, which is already nirvana, already peace. Cut off the five lower fetters, let go of the five higher fetters, and above all, cultivate the five faculties. A bhikkhu who surmounts five attachments is called someone who has crossed the flood. And you notice that the verse actually says, cut off the five, let go of the five, above all, cultivate the five. And if you read it that way, you would be very confused. But and this is often the way these verses go. It's confusing unless you know what it means by the five. And Gill, in his translation, fills that in for us. Cut off the five fetters, let go of the five higher fetters, and cultivate the five faculties. So the five lower fetters, and there are 10 fetters, right? Five sort of gross or relatively easy to overcome fetters, and five really subtle fetters that are really hard to overcome. So the five gross fetters or lower fetters, fetter as, you know, like a bondage or like a handcuffs or something. The five lower fetters are, first of all, views of self. Think about that. You know, every time you think that you are you, and you know you want what you want, and you're mad because you're not getting it, that's, you have a view of a self. That's the first fetter. Doubt is the second. Attachments to precepts and practices, and that means you know, if you're a monastic, you're attached to your robe, you're attached to your bowl, you know, you're attached to the precepts you follow. You're very proud of yourself. Sensual passion is the fourth, and ill will is the fifth. So those are the five lower fetters. The five higher fetters are attachment to form, and the form realm is the realm of meditation, a purified realm. So there's no sensuality in this realm. This is a pure meditation realm, but you can be attached to it, and that's a fetter. Attachment to the formless is the second higher fetter, and that is an even deeper meditation realm. But it also is something you could attach to, and attachment to that is a very subtle fetter. So that's the second one. And the third one is conceit, because if you have these fetters, you're already like a very experienced and powerful spiritual person, so you're conceited. Subtly, probably conceited. And there's a subtle restlessness, which is the fourth, and a fundamental ignorance has not been removed, and that's the fifth. So five higher and five lower fetters. So we're trying to get free, and we're making progress, but yet we're still bound in some way. The five faculties, which are the antidotes to these 10 fetters, are faith, and these are essential, spiritual qualities and practices. Faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, or prajna. The five attachments mentioned in the verse are the five skandhas in their characteristic of grasping. That sometimes they call them the five upadana skandhas. Upadana means grasping. So, and we know the five skandhas are the whole apparatus of our human experience. Form, meaning the body and the sense organs as physical things. Form, feelings, which are sensations. Perceptions, formations that we just talked about. And consciousness. These are the five skandhas. And when we're free of these five, they're still there, but they're not any that longer there as attachments. They're not there anymore as grasping. They're just there as plain and simple experience. And when we can live them that way, that means we've crossed over the flood, and now we've come to dry land. And the flood is samsara, and that connects to the metaphor of the boat that's full of water, right? And the safe dry land that we're going to get to on the other side is nirvana. Bhikkhu, be absorbed in meditation. Don't be negligent. Don't let your mind whirl about in sensual desire. So, we need to sit regularly. That's our practice. We sit every day, not just when we feel like it or once in a while, but we sit every day. And we sit also deeply, so we don't just sit a little bit. We sit every day, maybe not so much, but once in a while we sit a lot. A month, every month we sit for a day. Every year we sit at least once for a long session. So we sit regularly, we sit deeply. We don't neglect our zazen. We don't let our mind swirl around, caught up in this or that, which will happen less and less the more we cultivate our practice. Next verse says, don't be negligent and swallow a molten iron ball, a flaming iron ball. Don't swallow that. And then when it's burning you, spit it up and cry out, this is suffering. And that iron ball metaphor, was taken up by Master Mumon in the first case of the Mumon Koan, the Mu Koan, where he says, gulp the hot iron ball of Mu, which you can't spit it out and you can't swallow it, so you sit with it until you dissolve it, see through it. And he uses that same metaphor. I'm sure he gets it from this verse. But here the metaphor of the hot iron ball is used slightly differently. It's saying that not paying attention to your practice, not practicing, but just going along, bobbling along, as a human being without paying attention to your life, is swallowing a hot iron ball. And when you spit it out and it burns you and you're complaining, how did this happen to me? You're not recognizing that really, in the essence, you've done this to yourself because of your negligence. There is no meditative absorption for one without insight, and there is no insight for one without meditative absorption. And with both, one is close to nirvana. And this is actually a famous teaching of the sixth ancestor, Huainong, who in the Huainong Sutra says dhyana is prajna and prajna is dhyana. In other words, meditation is wisdom. And what's wisdom? Wisdom is meditation. They are one and the same. And this is more or less what the Dhammapada is saying too. Simply to concentrate and calm the mind and be a great meditator is not enough, because remember, there are these subtle fetters that still could very well be there, and in a way could be worse for you than the more gross fetters. So no, sitting per se is not enough, because the real sitting isn't sitting, it's the wisdom. And the wisdom, the understanding, without the stability of mind that sitting brings, is so wobbly that you couldn't even call it real wisdom at all. So it really is true. Sitting is wisdom, wisdom is sitting, and sitting and wisdom together is our life, the way we live, our true, actual human life. And that is more or less the teaching of Suzuki Roshi and of Dogen. For a bhikkhu with a peaceful mind who enters an empty dwelling and clearly sees the true Dharma, there is superhuman joy. So when the mind is peaceful and empty, the joy is not the usual joy. It is a superhuman joy. It's superhuman, literally, because ordinary human joy depends on something. And there may be some joy when that something is present, but as soon as it's gone, the joy goes. That's human joy. But Dharma joy is there no matter what is there, whether something is there or nothing is there. The bhikkhu's house is always empty, and so the joy is superhuman. Fully knowing the arising and passing of the skandhas, one attains joy and delight. For those who know this, this is the deathless. It's very simple, really. Our experience just comes and goes. You know, every moment comes and goes. Everything in this world comes and goes. To lament this as suffering, to embrace it and to know it fully is delightful. And here again, I think we've seen before the synonym. There are lots of synonyms for nirvana, and one of them is the deathless. The deathless is a synonym for nirvana. Death in Buddhism means restlessness that goes on and on and on and on. We're born and die again and again and again. Death is not an ending, it's the ongoing pain. So the deathless is peace, nirvana. The starting point for an insightful bhikkhu is guarding the senses, contentment, restraint according to the monastic rules, and associating with good spiritual friends who live purely and untiringly. So this verse begins the description of the life and the practice of a true bhikkhu. And it begins with taking care of the senses, including the mind, being content with whatever is present and not grasping. Following the monastic rules, if one is a monastic, or in our case, the 16 bodhisattva precepts, if one is not, and making sure that you associate with good spiritual friends, people who do the practice and also keep the precepts and, you know, will encourage you in doing that. And that's the simple formula for how a bhikkhu starts to practice. These are the elements of practice that she needs in the beginning, and in the middle, and at the end. If one is friendly by habit and skillful in conduct, one will have much delight and bring an end to suffering. As jasmine sheds its withered flowers, so bhikkhus shed passion and aversion. Peaceful in body, peaceful in speech, the bhikkhu, peaceful and well concentrated, who has rejected the world's bait, is called a person at peace. So friendliness is characteristic of the bhikkhu, of the practitioner, care in conduct. And here the verse says, you know, in a way, you know, it's just that simple. Just do that and suffering will come to an end just as naturally as a withered flower, when it's spent, will fall off the jasmine plant. Jasmine is a very nice, fragrant plant. The flowers of jasmine are very fragrant. And so in the metaphor, when you think about it, it seems as if the jasmine flower is going to bloom. And when it blooms, we're going to really enjoy it. And then when it's finished blooming, naturally, it withers. And we just allow it to wither, since that's what's going to happen anyway. So the world is a kind of a trap, beautiful and enticing. And that's the bait of the trap set to catch us. But when we don't take the bait, which means when we enjoy the blossom, but are fully content for the blossom to wither when it's going to wither, then we don't take the bait. We live in the world with freedom. We can enjoy it without getting caught. Admonish yourself. Control yourself. O bhikkhu, self-guarded and mindful, you will live happily. Oneself indeed is one's own protector. One does indeed make one's own destiny. Therefore, control yourself as a merchant does a fine horse. So one of the skills we have to develop in practice that I think many of us are not that good at is the ability to criticize ourselves as necessary without thinking that because we made a mistake or are deficient in this or that way, somehow this sort of negates our goodness and we're terrible people, you know, because of our shortcomings. So no, we have to learn how to say to ourselves, no, not good. That was a mistake. I should have done better there. I wasn't paying attention. I need to stretch myself here. And then we go on to do the best we can. We don't need the extra part, the self-recrimination and the self-condemnation, which really is just another kind of self-clinging, maybe a more pernicious kind of self-clinging than conceit and arrogance. Instead of that, we pay attention and rely on ourself as our best guide and teacher. After all, the only person who can do the practice where you are sitting is you. Nobody can do that for you. So really, we have no choice but to be our own best friend and our own best guide, even though we also have other friends and guides. But in the end, I think especially in our practice, we come to understand that those other people who are our friends and guides are actually us, and we are actually them. So we really have to value ourselves in our practice, and we have to train ourselves, and like a merchant who has a very valuable and fine horse that they paid a lot of money for, they take good care of that horse and they train that valuable horse well. Bhikkhu, filled with delight and pleased with Buddha's teachings, attains happiness and stilling of formations, the state of peace. And this is yet another of the many, many expressions in the Dhammapada about the joy and delight that the bhikkhu takes in the teachings and the practice. People who don't know about practice think it's like, how could this be fun, you know, sitting there doing nothing or listening to these boring ancient mumblings from afar. But actually, when you do it, you realize, wow, this is really great. It's nothing could be more delightful than this. And the Dhammapada keeps saying this over and over and over again, maybe trying to convince us, But I know, I think they just believe it. You know, the authors of the Dhammapada are really believing it and saying what they think. Engaged in the Buddha's teachings, even a young bhikkhu lights up this world like the moon set free from a cloud. So that is the last gorgeous verse of this chapter. And this beautiful image that I take very much to heart. I am always inspired to see a young bhikkhu, someone with faith and diligence, and maybe because they're young, without yet enough experience to have developed wisdom, and the promise of that person, and it's visible in the person, lights up the whole world, just like the full moon at night lights everything up, just like we've had here, the full moon lighting up the whole ocean, and outside it's like daytime, only enchanted daytime in the moonlight. And we had the other day the eclipse of the moon that Eva saw and made a picture of, and we saw it too. We actually got up. Believe me, this would not have been my idea, but certain other people in the household thought that it was the thing to do. So we got up 3:30 or something like that to see the eclipse of the moon, which was wondrous. Chapter 26, the Brahman. So chapter 25, the Bhikkhu. Chapter 26, the Brahman. So in the Buddha's time, a Brahman was a person born into the highest class, the priestly class, whose role was to chant the sacred scriptures, memorize them and chant them, and take care of the ritual life of the community, relating to the gods on behalf of the community. And to be a Brahman was to be a powerful and prestigious person. And nobody, it wasn't anybody who could become a Brahman. You couldn't, even if you were very skillful, become a Brahman unless you were born a Brahman. So what was radical about the Buddha, which doesn't seem as radical in our time, but at the time was really radical, was his insistence that outward roles and positions are not the measure of a person. What makes a person noble and truly worthwhile isn't birth or social status or social role or outward accomplishments of any sort, but a person's beautiful inner condition and conduct in the world that reflected that inner beauty. And such nobility was not a matter of birth or skill or something like that. It was the treasure that every human being possessed and that every human being without exception could achieve through diligent spiritual practice. So in this chapter, the Buddha is redefining the word Brahman in just this way. And this chapter can be read as a kind of repetition and a culmination of all the themes of the Dhammapada. There, I don't think there's anything much new in this chapter. It's just sort of a repetition and a reappreciation of all that the Dhammapada has been teaching. So we'll go through it, and I won't comment on every verse, but just the ones that seem interesting to me. Chapter 26, the Brahman. Strive and cut off the stream. O Brahman, dispel sensual craving. Knowing the ending of all formations, you, Brahman, will know the unmade. The unmade, with a capital U. So here again, as we've said, the metaphor of cutting off, and also, as we've seen before, the metaphor of breaking the spell of sensual craving, the spell of the sensual world, and ending the restless activity of formations, all of these things we've seen before in the Dhammapada. And the unmade, as I said a minute ago, is another synonym for nirvana. If formations make the world of suffering that we're caught up in, then nirvana, it would be the unmade. I think Kaz often, Dogen uses this word, and often Kaz translates it as unconstructed. Or there's one phrase, unconstructedness in stillness, and that's what's being said here. When, with tranquility and insight, The Brahman reaches the other shore, then for that knowing one, all fetters come to their end. So tranquility and insight are different English words for it, meaning meditation. Tranquility is meditation, insight is wisdom, as we discussed a minute ago. And the other shore, of course, is nirvana, cross the flood to the dry land, and all the 10 fetters that we talked about a minute ago are now broken, and the Brahman is free. Whoever is untied and free of distress, and for whom neither a beyond, a not beyond, nor a both beyond and not beyond exist, I call a Brahman. A beyond and a not beyond refers to the idea that you see in almost any religion, and it was certainly an important idea in a Brahmanic religion, that this world that we live in, which is so troublesome, is a false and a corrupt world, but that there's a world of truth, a pure world beyond this world. The Buddha of the Dhammapada teaches that any idea of beyond or not beyond or both beyond and not beyond is just that. It's a construction. It's an idea. Things are just as they are. They're impermanent and empty of own being. They appear and they disappear. They can be described extravagantly, like when we read the Gandavyuha, unbelievable realms on realms. They can be described as empty, nothing. But it's beyond all descriptions and all ideas of beyond and beyond and both or neither. A Brahman knows this and doesn't get caught up in any ideas about the world or any conceptions of the truth. Whoever is seated, absorbed in meditation, done what had to be done, free of constraints, who has reached the highest goal, I call a Brahman. So lots of lines that we'll see from now on in the chapter will end with the line, "This one I call a Brahman." And in other words, every verse is describing another quality that defines a Brahman. In this particular case, we learn that a Brahman always practices meditation and is specifically absorbed in meditation. And absorption sometimes is a word that's a synonym for meditation. And it implies fully engaged, fully concentrated, without distraction. The phrase, done what has to be done, is what refers to the Buddha's awakening. The Buddha says on awakening, I've done what needed to be done. And that's what awakening is. It's doing what needs to be done to fulfill the true promise of a human lifetime. We all have received human birth. Why? Well, the purpose of our human birth, to fulfill the promise of our human birth, we must awaken. The sun shines by day. The moon glows at night. The warrior shines in his armor. The Brahman shines in meditative absorption. I guess we can assume the warrior shines in his armor in the day. The Brahman shines in meditative absorption in the night, like the moon. The moon is always related to spiritual practice. But all day and all night, the Buddha shines in splendor. So this verse made me think, you know, now that we're in a war or another war, it made me think, you know, about this. The Buddha, I think, is pretty clear, despite various historical facts to the contrary. The teaching itself, I think, is pretty clear that the Buddha was a pacifist. And that the characteristic of a practitioner of the Dharma is a person who is loving and would not do harm. But here, the Buddha seems to be recognizing the existence in the world of the warrior who shines in his armor like the sun shines in the day. So the warrior has his sphere, and the Brahman who meditates has his sphere, and everything has its place. So that's a little, you know, you wouldn't think the Buddha would not be, you know, using the example of a warrior. You'd think that the Buddha would be like anti-warrior. But every ancient civilization had the idea of the warrior, the protector and conqueror that everyone admired. I remember many long, long time ago going to a poetry reading against the war in Vietnam, and one of my poetry teachers, the great poet Ted Berrigan, stood up to read his poem. He said, you know, usually poetry is about celebrating the warrior. Well, look at the Iliad, yeah, right? It's all about the celebration of the great warriors. And that's what poets do. They celebrate warriors and great leaders. He said, but now I can't celebrate the war in Vietnam. And then he read. So here the Buddha seems to be saying, that's right, we have great warriors, admired by all. And we still have this, don't we? This is the great warriors of the army and the navy. Even though nowadays war is no longer the exercise of, you know, physical courage and might and bravery, war is technical and more horrible than it ever was, and it was always horrible. Clearly, the Buddha was not a warrior and did not support warriors, even though he recognized their existence and the admiration that people have of them. Clearly, the Buddha saw himself and his Sangha as something else entirely. But I just think it made me, given what we're thinking about these days, notice that the Buddha sees that there is a path of a warrior. Of course, the warrior shines in the day. The Buddha shines both day and night. And there's no comparison in the Dhammapada between a warrior and a Buddha. Having banished evil, one is called a Brahman. Living peaceful, one is called a renunciant. Having driven out one's own impurities, one is called one who has gone forth. And going forth is a phrase that means entering the monastic path. And here the Buddha is saying that the real going forth isn't joining the Buddhist order, it's purifying the heart and becoming a truly peaceful person. One should not strike a Brahman, and a Brahman should not set anger loose. Shame on the one who hits a Brahman, and greater shame on the one who sets anger loose. So the importance of respecting spiritual adepts is repeated many, many times in the Dhammapada. So, you know, you don't want to hit anybody, but if you're going to hit somebody, don't let it be a Brahman, a spiritual adept. Don't do that. That's really bad. But should that happen, it is the duty of the Brahman and everyone who wants to practice to, as we know from the Christian tradition, turn the other cheek, not to lash out in defense, defend yourself, get upset, get angry, feel justified in lashing out. And this is worse than the original assault. For the Brahman, nothing is better than restraining the mind from what it cherishes. Whenever one turns away from the intent to harm, suffering is allayed. So the Brahman knows to be wary of what he cherishes, especially himself, which is the thing we all cherish more than anything else, right? So he's wary of that and restrains his mind and doesn't allow that kind of unbridled cherishing. And in this way, there cannot be any reason to want to harm another because there is nothing to defend or protect. And when there's nothing to defend or protect, there is no more suffering because there's no cause of suffering. Whoever does no ill through body, speech, and mind and is restrained in these three areas, I call a Brahman. As a Brahman worships a ritual fire, one should respectfully worship anyone from whom one might learn the Dharma of the fully self-awakened one. So traditionally, the Brahmin was the one who kept the sacred fire burning, and this was the source of his prestige and power. But here the verse is saying, redefining what a Brahmin really is, that more important than that is to be one who, to respect not a Brahmin who tends the fire, but one who is capable of teaching you the way of the awakened one. And that person would be someone harmless in body, speech, and mind. That would be the characteristic of such a person. Not by matted hair, not by a clan, not by birth does one become a Brahmin. The one in whom there is truth and Dharma is the one who is pure, is a real Brahmin. And again, this is the redefinition of what is a real Brahmin. What is a person really worthy of respect? Fool, what's the use of matted hair? What's the use of a deerskin robe? The tangled jungle is within you, and you groom the outside. So the point isn't what you look like, or even what you do on the outside. The point is the quality of your heart and the quality of your action. That's what the Buddha is saying again and again in this chapter. That's what a real Brahmin is. Someone robed in discarded rags, lean, with veins showing, alone in the forest, absorbed in meditation, I call a Brahmin. I call no one a Brahmin from being born from a womb, from a mother. Someone who has anything is called self-important. Whoever has nothing and does not cling, I call a Brahmin. Whoever, having cut off every fetter, does not tremble, is unbound and beyond attachment, I call a Brahmin. Whoever awakened has cut the strap, thong, cord, and bridle, and lifted up the crossbar, I call a Brahmin. So do not tremble in the verse I read a minute ago means is not made wobbly by sense desire, but remains stable and firm. And again, the unbound is yet another synonym for nirvana, unbound, deathless, unmade, synonyms for nirvana. And the strap, thong, cord, bridle, and crossbar are all devices that you use with your ox when you want your ox to plow and haul stuff around in a cart. You have to use these devices to, you know, hook the cart, the ox up to the cart, so the ox will do your bidding. And they are specific metaphors for the things that bind us and make us into dumb oxen doing someone else's bidding. Things like ignorance, craving, wrong views, and all the inner conditions that bind us and make us slaves to ourselves, the real tyrant and oppressor. Whoever endures abuse, assault, and imprisonment without animosity, and who has forbearance as one's strength, as one's mighty army, I call a Brahmin. This verse reminds me of the Tibetan monks who years ago were captured and imprisoned and tortured by the Chinese, but maintained their forbearance and compassion. And when they lamented what happened to them, their main lament was when they failed to be as compassionate toward their captors and their tormentors as they wished they had been. And these stories maybe sound too good to be true, and possibly they are, but I confess that I believe that they're true, or at least some of the stories are true. There were, I believe, some monastics, or maybe more than just a few, who were able to maintain this attitude of compassion even as they were being brutalized. And even though, sadly, time goes by, decades go by, and the Tibetans are losing their territory, they're losing their culture, they're losing their language, and in that sense, they are slowly being defeated. I think in a greater sense, their army of patient forbearance truly is a stronger army than the army of state power and state violence that the Chinese have employed against them. And I believe that the Tibetans' army will last longer than the Chinese army. Whoever is without anger or craving, observant in spiritual practice and virtue, self-controlled, and in one's final body, I call a Brahmin. Like water on a lotus leaf or a mustard seed on the tip of an awl, whoever does not cling to sensual craving, I call a Brahmin. So we've seen this image before and talked about it, of a water drop that drips off the edge of a lotus leaf. And here, added to that, is a mustard seed that you put on the top of an awl, you know, which of course you can't put it there, it just falls right off. And the Brahmin, so it has this kind of ease, you know, things will not stick to the Brahmin. In some sutra, there's the idea of some monastics who still are attached, and when people throw flowers on them, the flowers stick to them, you know. But the real monastics who have overcome attachment to flowers fall off easily. And so in that way, we slough off afflictive emotions, and we slough off sensual attachments, just like a mustard seed just falls off and all. Whoever knows right here the ending of suffering, who is unburdened and unbound, I call a Brahmin. Whoever is wise, of profound insight, understanding what is and isn't the path, and who has attained the highest goal, I call a Brahmin. Whoever is not mixed up with householders or renunciants, who has no abode and few desires, I call a Brahmin. Having given up violence toward beings both timid and strong, whoever neither kills nor causes other to kill, I call a Brahmin. Whoever is unopposing among those who oppose, peaceful among the violent, not clinging among those who cling, I call a Brahmin. So these verses again remind me of things I've been thinking about a lot lately in this time of war and conflict. I think it is clear enough that a practitioner doesn't indulge anger or practice violence, and that implies that a practitioner is always opposed to war. But what does it mean when it says not to cause others to kill? It may be clear enough, we're not going to kill, but how do we cause others to kill? Are we supposed to be stopping others from killing? To me, it's clear that we don't affirm or support violence or killing, even if it seems to be justified. Even if someone can say, well, this is a good war, it's going to have good effects, I feel anyway, that our feeling is, no, if people are killed and it's violence, we cannot affirm it, we cannot support it. But if the Brahmin is, as it says here, unopposing among those who opposed, doesn't that mean that to stridently condemn or stridently oppose war would mean that would be a violation of this teaching? Personally, I myself am against any war and any killing. If I ever thought there could be a war that was okay, I don't think that now. But I do recognize that I'm in a different position from someone who is responsible for protecting a population. And I'm certainly in a different position from someone who's a soldier. So, am I to condemn and oppose these people? Can I condemn others who support a war or support violence that I do not support? Should I condemn them and excoriate them and take them to task for what they do? I can disagree. I can express my commitment to peacefulness, but that's not the same as condemnation. So this is something I've been thinking about for a while, and these are just my thoughts. I don't put them out as some gospel or something like that, but I struggle with these things. Whoever lets passion, aversion, conceit, and hypocrisy fall away, like a mustard seed from the tip of an awl, I call a Brahmin. Whoever speaks what is true, informative, and not harsh, who gives offense to no one, I call a Brahmin. Whoever in this world takes nothing not given, whether it is long or short, large or small, beautiful or not, I call a Brahmin. Whoever has no longing for this world or the beyond, who is unbound and without longing, I call a Brahmin. Having no attachments and through understanding, free of doubts, whoever is established in the deathless, I call a Brahmin. Whoever here has overcome attachments for both merit and evil, and who is sorrowless, dustless, and pure, I call a Brahmin. And this last verse, this last line here, reminds me of our discussion a moment ago of the five higher fetters. Attachment to precepts and rituals, you might have noticed, is one of the fetters. I think it's actually one of the lower fetters, not one of the higher fetters. And, you know, this is a very common thing in religion. This is why religion becomes poisonous, right? You think, this is a great religion. I love it. And I hate the other guy who has a different religion because they don't understand how good my religion is. You know, that's what happens all the time. So you reject evil and you embrace good, which then rapidly becomes its own kind of attachment and leads to its own kind of suffering. Religious wars went on in Europe for something like 150 years. And it was Christians fighting against other Christians for about 150 years. The Brahmin is one who cleaves neither to good nor evil. The Brahmin practices good and doesn't practice evil, but doesn't cling to either one. Whoever, like the moon, is spotless, pure, clear, and undisturbed, in whom the delight for existence is extinct, I call a Brahmin. Whoever has passed beyond this troublesome road, this difficult path, this samsara, this delusion, who has crossed over, gone beyond, who is a meditator free of craving and doubt, without clinging, released, I call a Brahmin. I think those are really beautiful, wonderful verses. So the Brahmin clings neither to good nor even to life, because the Brahmin is just here, beyond any kind of craving, and therefore beyond any kind of doubt. Whoever, having given up passion here, would go forth as a homeless one in whom passion for existence is extinct, I call a Brahmin. Whoever, having given up craving here, would go forth as a homeless one in whom the craving for existence is extinct, I call a Brahmin. Whoever, having given up human bondage, has gone beyond heavenly bondage, is unbound from all bondage, I call a Brahmin. Whoever, having given up liking and disliking, has become cooled without attachments, a hero overcoming the entire world, I call a Brahmin. This not giving up liking and disliking is famous in Zen lore, because one of our common texts that we often study is the Xinshin Ming, Faith in Mind, whose opening verse, which appears as a koan in Blue Cliff Record, is "The great way is not difficult, just give up preferences." And whenever we study that verse, as we did a while ago, Kathy and I, we gave a little class at the Zen Center on this text. We always note when we study that line that there's no way preferences disappear. Preferences are an indelible feature of human consciousness. That's why we're so smart and so sharp. It's because of preferences. So the point is not to have no preferences. The point is to be free of preferences when they arise. So I prefer that. But that's not what happened. This happened. Okay, that's fine. That's what it means to give up liking and disliking. Whoever knows in every way the passing away and reappearing of beings and is unattached, awakened, and well gone, I call a Brahman. An Arhat whose destination is not known by gods, Gandhavas, or humans, whose toxins are extinct, I call a Brahman. One for whom nothing exists in front, behind, or in between, who has no clinging, who has nothing, I call a Brahman. Whoever is most excellent, a bull, a hero, a great sage, a conqueror, free of craving, cleansed and awakened, I call a Brahman. Whoever knows one's own former lives, sees both the heavens and the states of woe, has attained the end of birth, is a sage, perfected in the higher knowledges, and has perfected all perfections, I call a Brahma, a Brahman. Whew. That's the end. 422 or 3 verses of the Dhammapada. So we did it. I think this is not the first time we studied it, but maybe we never went through every verse the way we more or less went through every verse this time. I hope that it was enjoyable to you. I really enjoyed studying the text. And that's the end. Okay, so before we discuss, we don't have so much time. I kind of knew it would take a while to say all that and go through all those chapters, but a few announcements before, in case some of you have to leave. First, just to say we're sitting on Saturday. I guess everybody knows. We'll see you at Green Gulch at 9, and we're also, all the sittings are always online, so come online if you can't come in person. Starting next Wednesday, we're going to do 3 weeks on a Dogen text. A link to it is on the website. It's called Refrain from Unwholesome Action. And I thought it would be a really nice thing, as I said last week, to study Dogen on this question, which is all what the Dhammapada is about, unwholesome and wholesome action. So we'll study that text as well as we can for 3 weeks. And then on the 28th of this month now, on a Saturday, we'll for the first time have a special event outside of our sitting, outside of our monthly sitting at Green Gulch, to open up our practice period and install our shuso. And that'll be at the church on Saturday the 28th at 9 o'clock. I think that's the time, 9 o'clock. And all the information for signing up for the practice period is available. And it's we all appreciate this time of year. Once a year, we spend a short time, 6 or 8 weeks, intensifying our practice, sitting a little more, being a little more focused on our practice. It's a good thing every year to have a special time and to make a special effort. So we're all going to be doing that from May and from the end of March through more or less the end of May. Okay, so we don't have that much time, so I don't think this time we'll do groups, but I think maybe we can all talk together, raising the hands as we usually do. And I would say about two things, whichever one you want to bring up. One was the homework that I gave, the last homework assignment, which was to study craving in your own life and in your own mind and see what you can find out about yourself and about the procedure of craving, which is so common in our human life. So you could talk about that if you have something to say about that. Also, if not that, Let's talk about whatever you think about, now that we finished this big study, what do you think about, how was it for you to study the Dhammapada? What did it make you see or find out that you didn't see or find out before? Or how did it make you feel? Or what, did you have a big problem with it? And what was the problem? And so on and so on. Whatever you have to say about studying the Dhammapada. So Shafi is going to call on you, and if I